Brett Hayes is Associate Professor of Political Science at Union College. He's one of our best resources at WAMC, holds a PhD in Government Politics from the University of Maryland. He is an expert in American political development, constitutional politics, and American institutions. Welcome back, Brad.
Always great to be on with you, Alan.
Okay, so now we have an eight-person Supreme Court. You're a Supreme Court expert. Tell us about how that's all going.
Well, I suppose it's getting kind of mixed reviews, depending. But we've certainly seen the effect. There have been a number of high-profile cases that have come down with 4-4 splits. The case on public sector unions, the court essentially dismissed the case involving nonprofit obligations to provide contraception to employees under the Affordable Care Act. The court essentially punted that back down to the lower courts and, you know, kind of encouraged them to work on a compromise that had been kind of suggested by the government. And based on oral arguments to this point, we've seen that there's a likely 4-4 split on two more prominent cases, one dealing with abortion. There's a Texas law that requires doctors to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals if they perform abortions. And it also creates some standards for clinics that are akin to ambulatory surgical centers. And it's likely that if that law was in effect, it would reduce the number of clinics from 40 to around 10 in Texas. And based on the oral arguments, that looked like that was going to be an even split. There's an immigration case, United States versus Texas, that involves Obama's program that is going to, you know, if it's ever allowed to be implemented, it would allow about 4 million unauthorized immigrants who are either parents of citizens or of a lawful permanent resident to apply for a program that spares them from deportation and provides them with work permits. Those both look like they're going to be 4-4 splits. Now, what that essentially means is that in the case of the Texas law on abortion, that had been stayed by the lower courts, so that will not be able to go into effect. And Obama's program has been stayed, and that will not be able to go into effect. So, you know, depending on your, you know, on the left and the right, both have kind of lost under this 4-4 split. So, you know, it's kind of a mixed bag at this point. But one of the things that I think is pretty clear is that if you see the courts as having this role that it laid out for itself in Marbury versus Madison, which is, you know, to say what the law is, then the court is having a more difficult time doing that because of this divide.
But clearly, if you had one more conservative judge or one more liberal judge on the court, things would be very different.
Things would be different. And, you know, when we think a little bit about what this, you know, kind of 4-4 split has meant, right, that people have argued that it creates an incentive to compromise, right? And we see that to a certain extent in that case involving contraception and the Affordable Care Act, right, that the court essentially sent it back down to the lower courts and said, hey, why don't you work on this compromise provision? You know, that suggests a court that's not rendering decisions that are going to have long-term consequences. They're not setting, rules of law that will have precedential value. But, you know, at the same time, these compromises are also creating a certain kind of ambiguity. And what we're going to see increasingly until this vacancy is filled is that different lower courts, right, the U.S. courts of appeal, are going to be rendering decisions that interpret the Constitution differently, so that the Constitution is going to have a different flavor out in, say, California than it might in, say, Virginia.
Interesting. However, your earlier point is extraordinarily well taken, which is a lot of the perspective on this is whether you come from the left or the right in terms of public approval or disapproval of what's going on.
I mean, that's certainly true. I mean, obviously, if you're on the left, you've been losing a lot in the court over the last decade and a half. And the tie in some ways is welcome, right? It's certainly welcome on public sector unions, particularly before an election. And, you know, you might even be willing to take, you know, the trade-off on, say, abortion and immigration just to prevent, you know, significant losses, further erosion, say, of the right to privacy. So in that sense, you know, there is a certain kind of desirability. But thinking about the left here a little bit more and kind of incentives to compromise, you know, the left in particular has little incentive to try to compromise on rules of law. Now, they might compromise in ways that kind of avoid decisions, but not in ways that will render decisions that are difficult to overcome. Because if you're reading the tea leaves on the left, you know, you anticipate a Clinton victory in November and potentially majority control of the Senate. And if, in fact, that were to play out, right, you have a very different ballgame here with a 5-4 majority where you can really alter the legal landscape.
Not so fast, because the polls are showing 50-50 with Trump. And Trump did a remarkable thing. He released names of people who he thought would be good appointments to the United States Supreme Court. Did that rock you on your heels?
I liked it, actually. I mean, I'm a big fan of this. One of the things I think is problematic about our political system, particularly in presidential politics, is simply the lack of information about who's going to be running the government, right? So that, for example, we have no idea what Hillary Clinton's cabinet might look like. We have no idea what Donald Trump's cabinet might look like. And, you know, the same thing kind of goes for potential Supreme Court nominees. So I rather enjoyed the fact that he, you know, put out this list. And it was a fairly impressive list, particularly if you're a conservative. You know, there were six federal appeals court judges, all of whom were appointed by George W. Bush. There were five state Supreme Court judges, who were all appointed by Republican governors. Most had clerked for conservative Supreme Court justices, and many of the names are kind of conservative darlings. So it tells you something, right? I mean, one of the things that kind of pundits were speculating on prior to the list was that, well, you know, Trump is conservative on certain things, but social issues really haven't been one of them. And that we might expect a, you know, a Supreme Court under Trump that would be, you know, socially moderate. But, you know, according to this list, that would not be the case, that you would have a continuation of the, you know, the Roberts Court as we understood it before Scalia passed away.
Well, since Trump is a well-known liar who changes his mind a lot, who believes anything he says, including who he would appoint to the Supreme Court, right now he needs the Republicans behind him in the election. So he does what he has to do so they can raise money and the rest of it. But, you know, I, for one, think that he would have been a lot better off announcing a couple of progressive names because for the court, because then he would have dipped into the Democrats who were on the fence on this, or the independents.
I'm not so sure about that, in the sense that so much of our politics is polarized right now. And whereas once upon a time you used to win in the middle, now so much of it turns on being able to mobilize what is your base, you know, that 46% of the electorate that strongly identifies one way or the other. That is, you know, something that Trump is struggling with right now, in the sense that on a few issues, on trade, for example, he's running to the left of Hillary Clinton. And there are those in his core, you know, Republican conservative coalition that are very much concerned about whether he is a true conservative. And we know that that can really, really show up in a general election if you don't have those bona fides. So I think he really needed to do this. And we'll see what kind of effect. I think your point stands that the conservative response was not unanimously favorable to this. I mean, people mentioned the fact that he's a habitual liar and he is not trustworthy on this issue. But at least he's made some moves to try to shore up support.
Well, we disagree on this, but that doesn't mean that I don't have anything but respect for our wonderful Brad Hayes, professor in residence here at WAMC, who always offers a perspective that you got to think about. Brad, thanks for being with us. When we come back the next time, let's do a little bit more on Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton.
Sounds great, Alan.